is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, May 26, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. And Taylor, it's a big week this week. We're expecting some sort of development when it comes to the baseball talks. So we're going to find out, I think, what direction we're going to go. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm obviously waited with bated breath here to see how it goes down. I mean, Major League Baseball has clearly fallen behind. I mean, even college sports and coming up with a plan to come back. And that's a bad situation to be in. So I'm excited. I'm nervous and I'm interested to hear what you and our guests have to say about it because it is such a pivotal week.
Yeah, today we'll be talking with Matt Viskirjan about all that. And we'll also be getting his top five signature home run calls. We'll be speaking with Sarah Langs about that and about what type of teams could win in an 82-game shortened season. Some notes before we get to that. The Washington Nationals unveiled the design of their 2019 World Series championship ring on Sunday after players nixed a plan to hold a virtual ring presentation ceremony, an approach brought about by the coronavirus pandemic. And Taylor, when I saw these rings, I loved the baby shark cut inside of these rings. I thought that was appropriate for everything that went on last year.
I gotta say, I'm not super crazy about it.
Really?
I don't know. I feel like, you know, for Nationals fans, the baby shark thing was obviously great. It was a big little subplot in their World Series run, but I feel like it's kind of hacky. I felt like it was hacky at the time, and then to include it on the championship rings, it made me cringe a little bit. But if the players and the fans are happy with it, then whatever.
Yeah, and remember, the rings are for the Washington National players, and to a lesser degree for the Washington Nationals fans.
Yeah, they're certainly not for me.
That's why I was like, I thought it was cool. Yeah. Right, there you go. The plans for pro ball to resume in Japan are set for June 19th without fans in the stands. Teams can begin practice games on June 2nd, so that's just 2.5 weeks of a shortened spring training. The Astros, the Angels open their facility to players, The Tampa Bay Rays also held voluntary workouts at the Trop. Manager Kevin Cash, outfielder Austin Meadows spoke with reporters through Zoom.
Step in the right direction. It was great seeing everybody. I missed the first two pitchers because we kind of had to stagger it amongst coaches and staff there. But I saw a handful of pitchers and position players. I think they were excited just to get back to something that they're normal or used to, given that it was very unusual circumstances, kind of went through a back gate, and certainly we're wearing masks and trying to take every precautionary measure possible, but step in the right direction, and it's good to see some smiling faces.
Everybody obviously going in wearing masks. They had a station to wash their hands. Today I saw Mikey Perez and Jose Martinez up there. Played some catch, did a little bit of workout with DC, did some running, and obviously the main deal now is to try to stay in shape. You know, we're not sure when we'll be back out there, but hopefully soon. And the main thing is keeping our legs under us and staying in shape. But it was good to see new faces. I mean, it's been a while since we got to see each other and hang out, be on a routine. So today was it was good to have that little change of scenery.
Now, before we get to Matt and Sarah, I want to let you know that Jalen and Jacoby, the after show, rolls on even without The Last Dance. The guys are covering Lance, a two-part documentary breaking down the rise and fall of disgraced cyclist Lance Armstrong. The guys discuss Lance's early relationship with the cheating, what role his stepfather played in making him a great athlete, how he handled fame and money at such a young age, and his bout with stage 4 testicular cancer. I watched the first episode the other night. I loved it. But find the Jalen Jacoby podcast wherever you get your podcast. Matt Viskirjan, you know him from the MLB Network and, of course, the play-by-play man on Sunday Night Baseball. Matt, how are you spending your time? I was very – when we first spoke this morning, you mentioned that, well, I'm reading clips. I was like, nice. I like it. Matt's feeling some optimism about what's to come.
Yeah, I guess it's a combination of feeling optimistic and wanting to be informed. You know, at risk of kind of bumming yourself out because some of the rhetoric that's being thrown around on both sides, in fairness, does get us all a little bit aggravated. And Yeah, I guess I am optimistic. As far as killing time or spending time, at the outset of this, I, like many of us, thought, oh, okay, well, we got a few weeks to ourselves, get the house straightened up, catch up on some reading. I am 15 pages into my 550-page biography on Teddy Roosevelt, and they're the same 15 pages that I had read in February, pre-pandemic. So that didn't happen. You find yourself kind of kvetching about what's going to happen more than you do actually doing something productive with your time. And I got some notes straightened up from last year in my database, in my hard drive, because I have a bad habit of just filing things on loose leaf paper and throwing them in a drawer. So we got that cleaned up. And now it's let's play baseball and get out there again.
Have you been calling people and saying, hey, what do you hear? What do you know?
I have, yeah. With a few exceptions, you being one of them, most people are just parroting what they hear and what they read. Everybody that works in the business, people that work in baseball, people that work in sports TV, we go between being optimistic to digesting a piece of news right before we go to bed and then waking up a little bit bummed and not quite as optimistic as we were 12 hours earlier. It's all so hyper-reactive. That's how we are with news anyway. But in times like these, when people's livelihoods are at stake, when people's health is at stake, you really become hyperactive to news.
And it does feel like, Matt, that this week is absolutely a crossroad week. Well, we are going to learn a lot this week about whether or not this is going to go forward. What I've heard from various people involved in the process is that, you know, that stance that we heard from Tony Clark at the end of March, in early April, with statements that he put out, Scott Boras with what he said about, you know, the negotiations are over. We're never going to talk about this when it comes to financial issues with the players. Well, apparently they are going to talk about it. And there's going to be some sort of suggestion about, you know, maybe a rollback of some kind of the player salary, but not a lot. And there might be some deferred money involved. It might be that Major League Baseball says, look, we'll pay. And I don't know what the numbers are, but let's say, you know, a player makes $50,000 per game. Maybe that player instead is going to make 90% of that, $45,000 per game, with some of that money deferred. I think that the moderate forces on both sides are trying to find the middle ground of what works for the players, for the owners. What have you heard?
Yeah, that's I sure hope so. I'm hopeful that that's the case. And your information is usually the best, so I'm going to sign off on it. But a few things that I process when I go down that road. And the first is, I know that, you know, a lot of the rallying cry from the player side has been safety. And those are legitimate concerns, right? Just take one roster, for example. Just take the Dodgers. Dave Roberts, cancer survivor. Scott Alexander, diabetic. Keep going. Kenley Jansen, heart condition. Every team has these little mini concerns that you could categorize at more of an at-risk part of the population, so we want to keep them safe. I do believe that Major League Baseball will have these guys as safe as humanly possible, that they might be among the safest demographics in the country, akin to maybe what first responders are going through in terms of PPE, in terms of frequent testing. They're going to be wrapped in bubble wrap. So if a player has legitimate health concerns, I get it. I respect it. What I fear is too many other players are hiding their financial concerns behind rhetoric that makes it look like their only concern is their health, because they don't want to be vilified publicly by just talking money. And I hope that that's not the case. I suspect it is in some cases, and that bums me out. I go back and forth once again on this, and I do agree with you that this is a crucial week, but shouldn't we have expected a lot of this? I mean, if we were all naive enough to think that the Players Association was going to sign the first document handed to them, then we would have been disappointed. I don't think any of us were that naive, but I kind of expected some hand-wringing here, and I do believe they have a week. They might have beyond a week. I know that I had heard rumblings that at some point that Major League Baseball had a super-duper emergency plan in place that would have started in August. on the occasion that they can't come to an agreement for the 4th of July weekend. So even if this clock runs out on this week, I'm still optimistic that they'll get something done.
I feel like, Matt, that in a weird sort of way, how we got to this moment, although clearly not planned, because you're not planning for Blake Snell to be on Twitch and to be speaking about negotiations out loud, puts pressure on all of them to finish this, because we're hearing about, you know, the NBA getting ramped up, and we're hearing about the NHL getting ramped up, and baseball, which, you know, had the most pressing concern because they hadn't played any part of their season, seems in recent weeks to have been the sport that's lagging behind. And this argument between the two sides over the financial aspects and the public reaction to that, I think absolutely has ramped up the heat on both sides. And look, I've been shocked from the beginning when Scott Boras spoke so openly about this and about the money aspects, because maybe it's just being especially sensitive to it because I live here in New York. And every day when I open up the New York Times and I read the expanded obituary section, and you're reading about people and you're reading about all the folks who've lost jobs. And when, you know, I first started hearing that from Scott and the statements from Tony Clark, it just made me cringe because I was thinking people do not want to hear this. And then, in my opinion, the owners fed into that with some of the, you know, the well-timed leaks. Blake Snell fed into that. And I feel like because of all that underneath these negotiations is this bubbling heat on both sides. Yeah. Look, you better get it across because you do not want to have that narrative linger into 2021 about why there was no baseball in 2020.
Yeah, and we all know what's at stake with a new collective bargaining agreement right around the corner of this. Baseball still has a great opportunity to be a part of the feel-good story of the summer, and I sure hope they don't find a way to mess that up. Of concern, however, and you mentioned it, and no one would admit this on Sixth Avenue, but of concern is the fact that the other sports seem to be moving in a direction that's a little more agreeable internally than where baseball is right now. I'm not sure of that, but it just sounds like the NBA is moving forward without this kind of step back every couple of steps. So if, you know, and look at it from a TV standpoint, and this, you know, this impacts where you and I live. ESPN, our employer, TNT/Turner, they're heavily invested in the NBA. If, say, for example, nightmare scenario, baseball can't get their act together, and if the NBA does and they decide they're going to push their season back and they're going to start in December and play through the summer, then ESPN and TNT are going to have, and Turner, they're going to have their summer sports palette filled with a game that they're already heavily invested in. Do you think they're going to be in a real hurry to back up a huge Brinks truck of money to re-up another baseball deal, the likes of which the players benefit from now? That's the kind of stuff I don't know that the players all understand, the rank and file. They listen to the rhetoric from their leadership. I don't know if they put together the fact that the reason your contracts are so lucrative, the reason your existence is so good, is in part because of these mega deals that the league strikes with TV rights holders. And without that, the pool of money isn't as great. So don't screw up what we have in terms of a product on TV and online on various platforms for fans to digest and pay for. That's all at risk here. And I wish I knew that players got that. I know some of them do. Probably the vast majority of them do, but some of the hardliners might not process it that way, and that's unfortunate.
It's interesting you phrase it that way, because what I've heard from so many people involved in this is, oh my God, these guys are going to screw this up. I can't believe these guys are going to screw it up. And it wasn't always in reference to the players, but a lot of times it was. And I've asked that question of folks on both sides. Are you really going to risk the golden goose? Like this brinkmanship and this negotiation, are you really going to risk that? By the way, I should have mentioned this, that I guess one of the elements that the union has talked about is trying to, in some form or fashion, bolster those guys who are going to be free agents in the fall. And not guys like Mookie Betts, who's going to make a lot of money, maybe not as much money as we might have thought going into spring training. But, you know, Mookie Betts will be fine. I think there's a lot of concern on the player side that the rank and file free agents, the guys, journeyman guys who put in, you know, six, eight, 9 years in the big leagues are going to hit the free agent market in the fall at a time when the financial landscape is changing dramatically. And we know teams are not going to cut back on young players because they're cheap help. We know that the guys with existing contracts like Garrett Cole, like Mike Trout, they're fine. The place where they're going to do a lot of the cutbacks are with the free agents. And so from what I understand, they're trying to find some mechanism in place to protect those free agents. And I don't know if that's a, you know, a minimum, you know, a contract for veterans to get a major league deal. Let's say if you're a veteran, you get offered a major league deal, you get at least $2 or $3 million as opposed to getting the minimum. I don't know how it's going to play out, but I know that's one thing that the players have talked about.
Yeah, I get that. And I respect that. We get into that big philosophical discussion now. Is the market conspiring against players who are 37 years old, who've been in the big leagues for 12 years? Or is that just the end of the line? There's that discussion that enters in there as well. There's just so much to dig into here. The guys that are working this out are earning their paychecks. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And Matt, that's why I wrote last week, and I've been absolutely surprised that there hasn't been more discussion on the player side, on the leadership side, I should say, of the player association. Hey, we have leverage in this moment. Let's use it big picture, roll it into the next CBA. Let's get that going along so we get some relief when it comes to tanking, service time manipulation, free agency, like we just talked about. Because you know and I know, if they have a standoff and there's a feeling on the ownership side that they basically had to eat, you know, and I won't use the exact phrase, eat a sandwich that's not especially palatable with the situation this summer. The leverage pendulum is going to swing back the other way once we get into the offseason. And I felt like all along that like there was an opportunity for the players to address some big picture issues. What do you think?
Well said. And instead of, give me 100% of my salary in the spirit of negotiation, it would also not only serve that, it would behoove the union side to look squarely in the face of that expiring CBA and say, you want us to play, you want us to do a financial deal that makes sense for you. Got it. Done. Here's what we need. And none of that counterpoint has to do with 2020 salaries. Just, I mean, it's hard to say eat it. You can't espouse that when you're not among them. But I agree with you. There are so many places they could address what's bothered them ever since the current CBA was put in place. The current union leadership could polish itself up in the eyes of its constituents. There's a win on both sides here. They've just got to get it done.
All right. So last week, Sarah Langs kicked off this conversation that we started about signature home run calls and favorite signature home run calls. And I was like, I don't know if I want to be the one to do a top five. Let's put it on Matty B. So we did that and you've embraced it. So run us through your top five. If you want, you can go from number five to number one or number one to number five, however you want to handle it.
Yeah, let's go in reverse order here because it's easier, I think, to tackle this from a historical standpoint and get guys that are in the Hall of Fame and retired broadcasters because, I mean, after all, could you do any better than Hawk Harrelson or Jack Brickhouse? You couldn't. So, in deference to them, I have chosen to do only current major league broadcasters, radio and TV. And I know I'm leaving somebody out. There's no methodology here other than what kind of sticks in your brain and what resonates. So I'll go from number five on my top five play-by-play guy home run calls, starting with number five, Mets TV voice Gary Cohen.
McGlinchey staring in, has his sign. A 2-1 pitch. The drive in the air to deep right field. That ball headed toward the wall. That ball is out of here! Out of here! A game-winning grand slam home run!
It's perfect, right? It's three words. It's out of here! And he has that same kind of surprise in his cadence every time the ball gets out. It's perfect for imitations. It works. It sounds like baseball. And Gary cracks the top five. Number four, moving on to the radio booth. And down in the desert, Our friend and colleague Greg Schulte does a lot of things well. He's very good at his job, but among his best elements is home run call.
He hits this one in the air into left field. It's pretty well struck. Bank of the warning track of the wall. Puts the ball. Felipe Lopez. 1-0 Diamondbacks. That's a way to start.
And again, you get a guy who goes into this great register with his voice. And there's a little sing-songiness which makes it stick. Warning track. Whoa, you can touch them all. It's great. And the Govna, as he's referred to in Phoenix, he's awesome to listen to, and his home run call is great. Number three, we'll stay in the radio booth, and we'll pivot to a guy who's been doing it for a long, long time. And you could take a lot of his extemporaneous conversation chunks and cobble them together into a hilarious 30-minute non-sequitur tape. But when he's on point with his home run call, it's a good one. Mike Shannon of the St. Louis Cardinals.
Swing! And it's get up, baby! Get up, get up, get up! Home run! He's done it again!
Get up, baby! Get up, gone! McGuire hit that one out to the wagon gate.
I mean, he's great. Again, great to imitate, great to listen to. Home run call is awesome. Number two, and his brother has a good one as well, but I will tip my cap to the elder Kuiper, who's been calling Giants television for years and years and years, Dwayne Kuiper.
He hits it high. He hits it deep. It is out of here.
And he had plenty of opportunity to practice that, of course, with Bonds hitting them at such a prolific rate for such a long time. Not so much recently. And I think that's what makes me appreciate Kipe's home run call more and more now. The Giants just don't homer. So when they get a hold of one, he embraces it even more so than he did back in the day when Bonds was hitting him out at record paces. So the number one home run call, controversial, I think, just because this play-by-play man might not have the kind of, national recognition as a few of the others that I've mentioned and some of the guys that I've left out, unfortunately. But Greg Brown of the Pittsburgh Pirates checks every box with his home run call.
Drive deep to left center field and clear the deck. Cannonball coming. Chung Ho Gong gives the Pirates a 2-0 lead.
I mean, could there be anything better? Clear the deck, cannonball coming, all organic to the team. He hits it hard. He delivers it almost as though he's kind of smiling at his own cheekiness. You can hear it in his voice. So Greg Brown gets my vote for the number one home run call among active major league play-by-players.
Oh, that is a great list. And I, as you ran through them, I could hear them. I was laughing when you mentioned Mike Shannon. You know, I love those calls too, when it's like, and that's gone. There are times when he just, you know, and he's understated, like he's at the stage in his life where he's not going to bother with all the histrionics. He's just going to, okay, and that one's gone. And then you hear the crowd in St. Louis going crazy behind him. And you're right about Kipe. I love the importance of the moment feeding into that particular – it's the same wording, but I love the depth of feeling and the importance of the moment feeding into the power that he uses in his words.
It's true. That's a good way to put it. And, there's such a fine line. I think all these guys would agree – we would all agree, those of us that do this, that there's a fine line between having a signature home run call, quote-unquote, and being shticky and gimmicky and a clown. And nobody wants to be that, but I think it's okay to cross that line occasionally. And that's why these guys, when they hit their signature home run call, sometimes you can hear them kind of smiling at themselves. And I kind of love that self-reflective moment.
Tell me the first time that you remember somebody parroting your home run call back to you.
I think it was in the minor leagues. One of my minor league stops was in El Paso, Texas in the early 90s, and it was a great operation, sold out crowds every night, and they had this circus-like promotional atmosphere in the ballpark where when a player would go deep, he would cross home plate, rip his helmet off his head, and hand it behind the screen into the first row of the stands. whereupon the helmet is passed around the grandstand, stuffed with money, and given back to the player. Hard to imagine, isn't it? That,
yeah.
You know, in any place with 5,000 people, nobody would dip in with their own hand and pull out instead of contribute. But a big home run on a big game would net the guy a couple of $100. And at one point, there was a guy named Scott Talanoa, big first baseman. This is like 1993. And I asked him after the game, how much did that homer, because it was a game-winning homer, how much did that homer net you? And he said the dollar amount, and then he said, Santa Maria. And I was like, wow, you're listening to my tired act on the radio, on the 5-watt radio station that we were on that year.
Oh, that is awesome. And when you've been out and about and people recognize you, how much do you hear that? Like when people yell that out?
Very infrequently, gratefully. I enjoy my anonymity in life. And on the rare occasion, it usually happens at a ballpark setting. If I go to a game as a fan, which I still do as frequently as I can, it's usually a kid, and I get a lot of run from the MLB The Show video game that I've voiced since 2005, actually, which is pretty incredible looking back that I've done anything that long without being fired. But it's usually a kid that does it, or a drunk guy. Drunk guys are big with that too.
Well, I hear it. I got to tell you, cause that your voice is, I told you this story last summer. I'm like, did Matt show up? Did somebody tell me to go downstairs? And it's Jake, my 15-year-old son playing the game. And I'm like, okay, now I get it.
Yeah. Tell Jake. I mean, I tell this to all my friends with kids who play the game. No offense taken if dad announces at some point midseason that the game shall be played with the sound off until further notice. I get it.
Oh, man. Well, I hope your prep pays off in the weeks ahead and we could actually do games. I'm assuming I saw an interview you did the other day where you talked about the possibility of doing the games from home, as we're seeing in the KBO broadcast. I haven't heard anything, but I mean, let's face it, whether it's Major League Baseball, whether it's ESPN, there's always the question of liability, and they're going to want to keep people safe.
Yeah, I was hopeful that maybe the bigger national weekend rights holders like Fox on Saturday, ESPN on Sunday might find a way to get us out there. But again, without anybody telling me that this is the case, I'm just kind of assuming that we're all going to be in a studio or at home. And by the way, our friend and colleague, Book Shambi, do not sleep on his wall that he has created in his home set in his apartment in New York City as the voice of KBO baseball on ESPN. He's cobbled together a very unusual series of photographs behind him for those on camera shots. I think it demands a freeze on screen and an explanation of each one. There's something there with all of those. And I freeze it on the DVR just to look at what nonsense he's got on his walls. But put him down for a podcast in the near future before the KBO is bumped off the air so we can get an explanation.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do that, and not to date myself, but it did remind me when I first started looking at it. That's like the Sergeant Pepper's album cover, right? Where you're like, okay, what's that from? What's this from? If anybody hasn't heard what Sergeant Pepper's, you know, God help you. All right, Matt.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Numbers game.
Sarah Lang's a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, as I said to Matt, I mean, his appearance in selecting the top five signature home run calls was inspired by you and your suggestion last week. So what'd you think of his list?
You know, I like it. I understand. I like the humility, and not, of course, he wouldn't put himself on the list, but you know, based on what I said last week and everything, I had him on the list. I love hearing that one from him, but I think he did well. I mean, I think I would have had Dwayne Kuiper's number one, but I understand. And I don't know the older Pirates calls quite as well. And, you know, we aren't all listening to Pirates games maybe quite as much these days. So, and I watch a lot of Giants games. So there may be some bias there.
I was going to say, you got some Giants genes in your past, right? I mean, with your mom's
exactly.
And her fandom there, and you watch the Giants all the time. We're hoping that by the end of the week, we're going to start to get some sort of a feel on the possibility of a return of Major League Baseball. And it's been interesting to have conversations with general managers in recent weeks about you know, teams that might have an advantage. It certainly is going to level the playing field. The margin for error is going to get smaller. You might have a, you know, a second division team that gets red hot. And we've seen this from teams like the Marlins in recent years where they, you know, they whip off 8 wins in 10 games and suddenly we start talking about them and then they disappear. Well, in an 82-game season, that wouldn't be the case. What are some factors, some things you think could really play in a shortened season?
Yeah, you know, to me, it seems to all come down to the pitching side. I mean, you know, hitters are going to hit. That sounds like one of those baseball phrases we hear all the time. Maybe a little too cliche, but that's sort of, you know, I don't think that there's as much of a strategic advantage or, you know, something that could be different. If your team can't hit, it's not going to go well, no matter how many games you're playing. But I think that pitching is where we could see a lot of different maneuvering and where we could definitely see some teams having a clear advantage. And I really think it comes down to bullpens because I don't think we know exactly what, you know, state pitchers might be in if this were to resume in terms of even how many starts they might be making or anything else like that. And, you know, having flexibility and having a good bullpen seems like it would be the most important thing. And honestly, I feel like that's what most seasons come down to. And then the Nationals proved us wrong, but we don't need to get into that part. But, you know, so I looked at the top bullpen ERAs in 2019. It was the Rays, the Indians, the Astros, the Dodgers, and the Cardinals. And, you know, the Rays bullpen is intact. We saw that bullpen in the postseason. The Indians bullpen is, for the most part, intact from last year. Tyler Clippard was really good for them. He's now on the Twins. But they've still got Brad Hand and Nick Wittgren, who were really good for them. The Astros are missing Will Harris now, who I know he gave up that big home run to Howie Kendrick, and now he's on the Nationals. But aside from that, he was really good for them and really good for them in the regular season. The Dodgers, you know, Kenley Jansen didn't look like Kenley Jansen last year in the same way. He did have a 3 ERA, but it wasn't quite Kenley. So that's a question for them regardless. And, you know, is Joe Kelly going to bounce back and be the reliever they signed him to be? Another big question for them. And then, you know, the Cardinals, I think that the biggest thing there is, you know, when might Jordan Hicks be back? And that's something that goes for a lot of teams with, you know, injury timelines. And of course, the Yankees come up there just overall as a team, and especially with some of their pitchers, just when guys might be due back. But I do think that in addition to the bullpen, you also need to have the solid starters. And this is what I've said so much about the opener, is that the opener works well because Blake Snell and Tyler Glasnow and Charlie Morton are there. So if you look at those teams and sort of consider how strong they are in the starting realm, I think the Astros could have some questions because, you know, Zach Greinke didn't look great in the postseason and Garrett Cole is gone now. And we don't know what kind of workload a guy like Lance McCullers might be.
You know, one big X factor in all this is going to be how each of the organizations handles their young pitching prospects. Mm-hmm. Because let's face it, if there's no minor league games this summer, then the question is for every organization is, what's the best way to develop our best pitching prospects in this unusual situation? You know, do we shut them down for the whole summer? Or, you know what, we don't have to worry about innings limits. Let's just pitch them. And I suspect that a lot of the best arms with these expanded taxi squads that we're going to hear about, I'm sure, teams might just decide, hey, just throw these guys in. You know, a guy who might have been pitching in Double A, just use him out of the bullpen. Just give him some time, some appearances there. And there might be, I mean, we've seen in baseball history so many examples of young pitchers coming up and having a big impact in the bullpen. Fernando Valenzuela, before that incredible season in 1981, at the end of 1980, he had a huge impact in the Dodgers bullpen. Francisco Rodriguez, K-Rod, back in 2002 toward the end of the year, young pitcher comes up. Great stuff, overwhelms hitters. I would not be surprised if we see guys like that. And I do wonder about a team like the Padres, you know, who are loaded with these young pitching prospects. If you're looking for a way to develop these guys, maybe that's an avenue we're going to see some teams take.
Yeah. And I mean, just to add to your list, I mean, we saw David Price, you know, in that postseason before he became a starter. And I mean, even a guy like Adam Wainwright, you know, and we've also seen teams take that approach, you know, regardless of this kind of situation. I mean, that's how the White Sox brought Chris Sale up. You know, he was strictly a reliever initially, and they did the same thing with Carlos Rodon, I think, when they first brought him up. I think that makes sense. I mean, you know, if you just look at the season as, you know, there's going to be this fixed amount of innings aside from extra innings or whatever else, whatever that number may be, you know, you need to do what's best for your organization within that framework.
Yep. 100%. All right. Historically, we haven't had a lot of examples of seasons that are truncated. Certainly 1981, maybe the best example. What are some of the best performances we've seen in those shortened seasons?
Yeah. So I took a look at, player performances in seasons where they only played 82 games or fewer. Obviously just right around half a season there. And, you know, I think that we have the strike shortened seasons as examples, but obviously there were more than 100 games played in both of those years. And I was really curious, you know, when we get into the 80s, kind of 70s, that sort of arena, what numbers are we talking about? So the most homers by a batter in a season where he played 82 or fewer games is 27 by Giancarlo Stanton in 2015. Mm. He broke his hamate bone in June, which ended his season at 74 games. And Joey Gallo had 22 homers last year. That's fifth on the list. So there's about 10 guys who had 20 plus home runs. So that's sort of what we're talking about there. And then I looked at WAR for position players on Baseball Reference in the modern era. And the most on that list is 4.7 by Justin Morneau in 2010. He had that concussion, which cut his season short. And then Hubie Brooks in 1986 also tied with 4.7. He tore some ligaments in his thumb right after the All-Star break. He was an All-Star. He was having a great, great season. And then pitchers a little different, obviously. But what I looked at was guys to make 15 or fewer starts and not have a relief appearance. So obviously, especially with what we were talking about, there could be guys who end up coming out of the bullpen too. It's probably not going to be quite this black and white, but that's just what I did to take out, you know, really top reliever seasons. I'm not talking about what Josh Hader has done. So the most strikeouts in a season where a pitcher had 15 or fewer starts but no relief appearances was 118 by Jose De Leon in 1983 for the Pirates. Mm-hmm. He made his MLB debut in July, so that's why he had that many starts. And there's only two other guys who had 100 or more strikeouts in that kind of season. Lance McCullers, who I mentioned before, had 104 in 2016, and then he dealt with the elbow injury. And Dinelson Lamet last year, 105, came back from Tommy John in July and was off.
Wow. Yeah, it's interesting. When you mentioned Joey Gallo and the home runs he hit last year, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, you know what? We're going to be talking so much, you know, assuming the games resume, about our players wearing masks, our umpires wearing masks, or their high fives. Probably my guess is they're going to be microphones. So much to distract us from the whole conversation around the baseball and whether or not the baseball is used. And at some point, we're probably going to be like, hey, there are not as many home runs, or yeah, there are as many home runs as last year. So it'll there'll be a lot to talk about, you know, if and when baseball comes back this year. Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Here's Tim Kirchin's daily baseball fix about Harvey Haddix's throwing 12 perfect innings.
Hi, this is Tim Kirchin, and on this date in 1959, Pirates pitcher Harvey Haddix threw 12 perfect innings, 36 up, 36 down against the Milwaukee Braves. Haddix and Pedro Martinez in 1995 are the only pitchers ever to take a perfect game into extra innings. Pirates second baseman Bill Mazeroski told me, "It's one of the greatest games I've ever been a part of." He said there was only one hard hit ball. I was totally in awe of what was happening, and we all knew that history was being made. Mazeroski said that Haddix tried to mix it up with teammates in between innings, but no one would talk to him because, Mazeroski said, we all knew what the hell was going on. So Haddix lost the perfect game and the no-hitter and the game in the 13th inning. But 20 minutes after the game was over, Mazeroski told me the entire team went over and congratulated Harvey Haddix because he said he did something that no one had ever done.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. First up, Sterling at StirRide73 writes in, other than the obvious Oakland and Tampa Bay, what are the five ballparks most in need of a teardown?
Man, Sterling, five.
How about two?
Man, oh, man.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and I also feel weird about like spending other people's money, because if you're going to tear it down, you got to replace it, and with the rare exceptions of ballparks like in San Francisco, usually they're public funded, and you know, and I know right now, not a lot of money for public funded ballparks. Boy, I'd say just in terms of being a baseball facility, I think the Rogers Center in Toronto, Skydome was amazing when it opened. It feels outdated now, and any place where you're going to have artificial surface, I'm not in favor of. So that would be the one I would nominate. What about you, Taylor?
I think that's a good one, actually. I think Toronto deserves something a little bit nicer.
Yeah.
You know, it is basically the jewel of baseball in that country. So I'll just stick with you. That's a good call there.
Okay.
Let's go
but
to the
five. Five.
Five's a lot.
That's like 1/6 of the ballparks. I can't go there.
Next one up, Brandon Paul, wrestler at Win for Gwyn, writes in a follow-up to something we talked about on Friday. Jeff Kent had his share of divaness, and he was on Survivor, and he was on season 12. He made the top 10, and he displayed some of that divaness when he was voted off. So the winner gets a $1 million prize, and he said basically that, I don't care. It's going to be 600 grand by the time the tax man takes it, so peace out.
Brandon, you know what? That's a good idea. I'm going to have to reach out to Jeff Kent. I've had a couple of good conversations with him. Maybe he could join us on the show and give us some memories of his time in baseball and also on Survivor.
Oh, that would be a lot of fun.
Yep.
Last one up for today. Another follow up from Debbie Gammons Brown. She writes in, if you went to a baseball game with Abraham Lincoln, as you said you wanted to on Friday, who do you think he would have been a fan of? The Cubs or the White Sox, or maybe another team? Maybe he's a Nationals
guy. Because in his time in Illinois, he lived in Springfield, then I think he'd be closer to being a South Sider than a North Sider. So I would say the White Sox. But also, he generally, I think, was more inclined to the underdogs. You know, he related the underdogs. So I think he would like the White Sox better.
Alrighty, that does it for Bleacher Tweets for today. Thanks for listening. We got plenty of good tweets over the weekend from you folks while you were enjoying your Memorial Day.
And we'll hit on them as we go along this week. That's it for today. My thanks to Matt, Sarah, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/PodCenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.